Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We're going to have mostly good news this week. So in this week's program, we'll be talking about functional medicine and how a recently published study shows how it helps patients with rheumatoid arthritis, improving their scores above what is achievable by conventional therapy. We'll also revisit the latest news about Zika. Remember Zika? And we'll explore the wonderful new discoveries about a biological trash that turns out to be an anti-inflammatory treasure. But let's move first to functional medicine. Functional medicine is a way of thinking about the body and the behavior of the person in that body and how it feeds into their disease process. It also looks at nutrition, and it thinks of food as the first line therapy to prevent, treat, and reverse chronic disease. Well, a study just published in PLOS, Public Library of Science 1, supports that. I know the authors of this study. So they are some of my teachers in functional medicine. This study came out of the Cleveland Clinic functional medicine department, which has a backlog now of almost a year to see people because, hey, word gets around. Functional medicine provides individualized patient-centered care, and it looks at a patient's signs and symptoms along with their lifestyle, environment, and genetic factors to try and identify the underlying drivers of their chronic disease. So in the case of this study for patients with inflammatory arthritis, the initial approach included a detailed medical history that included birth history, because, hey, if you're a C-section, you got antibiotics at birth. That's pro-inflammatory, and it messes up your microbiome. Also, antibiotic use, environmental exposures, digestive history, infection history, and initial testing, which includes nutrition status, gluten antibodies, an analysis of the microbiome, an analysis of toxins, and hidden infections as indicated by the history and clinical presentation. So you might go looking for Lyme disease in a rheumatoid arthritis patient who lives in Lyme, Connecticut, but you wouldn't do that for someone in Arizona. Individualized medicine. The practitioners treat the patient using nutrition, as well as first-line therapy focusing on an anti-inflammatory, low-glycemic, nutrient-rich food plan. We like to get people consuming fresh, brightly colored vegetables, low-glycemic fruits like blueberries and strawberries, and lots of non-processed foods. Often dietary supplements are used to balance nutritional deficiencies, and by utilizing plant-based antioxidants and anti-inflammatory herbs, and also prebiotics and probiotics to modify the gut microbiome, we can modify the immune response in an individual like these in rheumatoid arthritis who have a autoimmune disease. So this is very, very exciting work. I want to emphasize this cannot be a double-blind study, right? Because people can't be given a sugar pill that represents dietary behavior and lifestyle behavior. So the patients who are getting treated know that they're being treated. This was two groups, functional medicine group and a other group with rheumatoid arthritis. They both received the same rheumatologic standard medical care. So the best of standard medical care at a rheumatology clinic at the Cleveland Clinic. And so this group, these two groups were different, and the one group got value added with the functional medicine. They had 54 patients. The average age was 53. About 67% of them were female. And the baseline characteristics, including their pain scores and physical health, were similar in both groups. Patients in the functional medicine group had a statistically significant reduction in their pain. The p-value there was 0.007, and so 0.05 is good. This was seven times better. and change in the physical health score as identified by an objective measurement by physical therapists. That also had a very high p-value of 0.001 compared to just standard care. So we can look at that and we can say functional medicine provides serious value added. And you always hear me talking about the microbiome. We're going to talk some more about the microbiome this program. But inflammation is either inhibited or stimulated by what is going on in your gut, both your microbiome and what you put in your mouth. So eating an anti-inflammatory diet is extremely important. And that means eating the rainbow, lots of colorful fruits and vegetables. In the wintertime, you may have to use frozen just for cost considerations. But the key is a wide variety. Try to get something red, orange, yellow, and blue, purple every day. Oh, and don't forget the green, left out of color. Try to change what you're consuming. The wider the variety, the better your microbiome. Now, I said it was mostly good news. Our next one is just a little bit of bad news, so rather a warning about a new black box warning on a widely used drug, Singulair. The generic name for that is Montelukast, Lukast with a K. And Montelukast, or Singulair, is asthma and allergy. It was originally derived for asthma treatment, but then easily a decade ago, it got the secondary indication for allergic rhinitis. It is a leukotriene antagonist. It prevents the production of these inflammatory cytokines. Now, you've all heard of prostaglandins. Well, leukotrienes are also made from arachidonic acid, the same source as the prostaglandins, which are blocked by drugs like ibuprofen and the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Well, this is the 1-2 punch of inflammation. Leukotrienes are especially active in allergic diseases, and so blocking them really helps people with asthma and allergies. And this drug's been around a long time. It's pretty unusual for a black box warning to show up this late. This thing's been generic for a while. But recent reviews have raised a possibility that this drug may have some rather substantial mental health side effects. And while the risk is small, there's a substantial potential for harm in these. And so as a result, they're saying if you really should not use it for allergic rhinitis, if you can get by with Flonase or Beconase or Astelin, which is a nasal spray antihistamine, you probably don't want to be taking this drug. I'll list some of the things. Depression, really bad or vivid dreams, memory problems, worsening of stuttering, sleepwalking, obsessive compulsive. And then the list, it's basically just everything that can go wrong with your brain, including hallucinations. So we really don't want to be using this for just allergic rhinitis. However, because asthma can be life-threatening and this side effect is rare, I want to emphasize that if you are already taking this and tolerating it, particularly if you're asthmatic, please continue, but watch for mental health status changes. They are reversible, and it is probably more significant in children because they're smaller, and so I personally am not going to use this in the pediatric group. I'm going to wait till people weigh 100 pounds and have a mature liver before I throw this at them. So our next story is about drug mining. And you've heard of data mining. Well, drug mining is where you go back and you search old drugs that may have been around for longer than Montelukast, for example. Maybe old antibiotics that nobody even uses anymore. And the reason you do that is that we now have these amazing artificial intelligence search agents that can look at the structure of the molecule and postulate what other drugs might interact or what it might interact with. This is how remdesivir was identified for the treatment of COVID. It was an agent that was tested early on. and found to have the right lock and key mechanism to potentially disable the spike protein. And there's the data on remdesivir is mixed. It seems like a weather vane. Each time I look for studies on it, it's like latest study shows it works. Oops, latest study shows it doesn't. Oops, well, or maybe it depends on when you give it. So it doesn't exactly tell us everything we need to know, but it does give us a first start. In this case, National Institute of Health researchers used a bunch of drug screening techniques to try out 10,000 different compounds to try and treat Zika. This is back in 2015. Remember Zika? Hundreds of children born with brain deformities. There were global outbreaks. Some of the children were born literally with no brains. Some of them were mentally retarded. There are other effects to Zika. Turns out a widely used old antibiotic called methicycline, relative of tetracycline, has been shown to be effective at preventing brain infections and reducing the sequelae, that is to say, the after effects of Zika, in mice who were infected in the virus. And they also found that a drug that was originally designed to combat Alzheimer's disease and inflammation may also fight infections. Now, you'll remember that Zika is a mosquito-borne illness, so it tended to occur in the tropics, and it was only discovered after a high number of babies were born with very, very abnormally small heads, a condition called fetal microcephaly. There were also cases of adults who got neurological disorders, including Guillain-Barré, a form of paralysis that's kind of an autoimmune, and also encephalitis. So the researchers were looking for drugs that blocked a protein called NS2B Zika virus protease. We've been hearing a lot about viral infections, so this will make sense to you. During an infection, the virus injects the RNA into the cell, resulting in the production of these proteins, which are all strung together, like I described last week, on a chain. But in order for the proteins to be useful, they have to be clipped with a molecular scissors. Think about those old model airplane kits. I'm dating myself, I know, but then you probably knew. Anyway, so they were a flat piece of plastic, and all the parts were there, but you had to kind of snap them off and sand down the little edges that were left from the way it was all connected together. Well, imagine that the viral genome has been translated, and once it's translated, it gets snipped into pieces, and then the pieces spontaneously assemble into a virus particle with more RNA inside, which is amazing all by itself. So blocking the protease effectively defangs the disease. And they found a number of drugs. They found about 2,000 compounds. And so then they did a large-scale screen. And ultimately, the Zika has been tested out. This methicycline has been tested out to see whether it would work. They did some stem cell studies in petri dishes, and that narrowed it down to 3 drugs, including the methicycline. Then they used Zika-infected newborn mice, and the mice did much better than those given placebo when they were infected. And then, of course, the mice were quote-unquote sacrificed, which, by the way, means killed, and their brains were looked at under a microscope, and they showed that the antibiotic reduced the infections and reduced the neural damage. Questions, will it cross the placenta? Yes. Answer, it will. Is it a drug that we would be willing to give to all pregnant women? Well, there can be some problems with tetracycline in terms of the teeth, which can develop abnormally. Might not be such a bad trade-off to have poorly developed teeth rather than a poorly developed brain. So we're going to go to our first email. This email comes from an anonymous emailer. I hope the good doctor will take a look at this article about company Thrive and give us an opinion on their approach to gut microbiome analysis. The founders come from top-notch schools. I have absolutely no connection to this company. So I took a little effort, but I did manage to review the Thrive. And first, I'm going to talk about microbiome testing. This is a growth industry, pardon the pun, and there are a number of entities which are further along in terms of already being to market. So my first question to the anonymous emailer is, are we asking about this question as an investor in the company or as a patient thinking of trying to learn more about their microbiome? Because I would say that as an investor, it has some potential advantages over some of the existing products. However, as a patient, I would say the opposite. So how about that for starting? I love the microbiome, and I've started to see more and more of these tests. I have patients coming in now with Viome and Ubiome or Genova GIFX or Day 2, which Day 2 is a really interesting one because its goal is to evaluate your microbiome and try to shift it using diet away from diabetes. There are some studies out, published data, showing that you improve diabetic control by altering the microbiome. And so they're looking at the microbiome as, well, essentially a dial or a lever to shift physiology. And we know that that works. Thrive, the company that the emailer wanted to know about, does two things. It looks at the bacterial DNA, but it also analyzes your DNA a little bit. And it then gives you a list of a food list, which is a list of recommended foods which are going to probably increase your bacterial diversity and your ratios. And they may contain, you know, certain specific foods like, you know, this particular compound is going to raise your bifidobacterium. And these things are known from all of the microbiome studies. So it's a reasonable thing to do. They also are very happy to sell you customized probiotics. And I'll tell you, customized probiotics doesn't make a lot of sense. The best way to alter your microbiome is to alter your diet. And so if you take probiotics that are customized in the sense that they're supposed to raise your levels of things, you're going to have to keep taking them because a lot of times the probiotics that are able to be grown in factories are not actually the kind that can successfully take root in your gut. As a functional medicine doctor, I will tell you, it's more like gardening. And if you've got a vacant lot over there that's got thistle and weeds growing in it, throwing flower seeds at the vacant lot will not get you many flowers. You kind of have to do soil amendment, and you kind of have to get rid of all of the overgrowth. And that's why in functional medicine, we are treating the microbiome in a different way. We're using diet, and we're using certain probiotics as placeholders, but we're really trying to open up a space on the soil, get the soil amended so that the gut is healthy in terms of its other parameters, and then give the person the food that's going to allow their own probiotics to grow and keep the bad guys away by putting external probiotics down as ground cover for the first 6 to 12 weeks while that growth is taking place. After that, we're hoping for a self-sustaining new and improved microbiome that we're going to maintain with diet. There's another company, Atlas, and I found a nice article which I will send to the emailer that compares them. There's a diet app that I keep seeing all over the place that is going to change the way you eat. Atlas is aiming to do that. It does the same thing. It gives you bacterial ratio, bacterial diversity, doesn't check your DNA, gives you weekly food tips. They also have an app where you can take a photo of your food and get a robogue critique in terms of, is this good for your microbiome or not? Now, they start to sound okay. Maybe that could be useful for me. But the problem is I found a review by a guy who took the same piece of poo and sent it to both labs on the same day after the same diet. And the labs varied quite a bit in terms of their analysis. The percentages were off by a lot, even allowing for the fact that you might have different growth techniques. But if someone tells you that you've got 11% of your microbiome as bifidobacterium and somebody else tells you that you've got 2%, you have to wonder whether that lack of inter-observer variability doesn't indicate that this science isn't ready for prime time. So where I'm going with this is, it's about as useful as 23andMe. It is interesting, but the report that you get from 23andMe isn't going to tell you how to live or how to behave or what to change about your lifestyle. In order to do that, you have to really work on the functional medicine things that are embedded there in the raw report. And that's something that I've gotten very interested in doing in my practice and actually really enjoy, because we find often things that can really pinpoint issues that the person may not have come in with, like skin, hair, their lipid profile, things like that. That wasn't why we looked, but when you take that 23andMe and analyze it from a functional medicine perspective, you get some really interesting stuff. I'm in the process right now of taking a training to get better at this, because I think this is the medicine of the future. Medicine of the future is what we're all about here. So that is the big answer to a small question. I wanted to give you a editorial that appeared in the August 13th, 2020, New England Journal of Medicine. And it was written by the Independent Particular Matter Review Panel. And so backstory here is that for many, many years, the EPA has had an integrated review panel of scientists who make recommendations for standards. Like, for example, in the case of this, particulates. 2.5 microns, right? That's a big number, because that's what a HEPA filter filters out. And we have, of course, been all about those N95 masks in the last few months. We all know what those are now. And they also filter out at the 2.5 microns. When it gets that small at 2.5, it can get all the way down deep into the lungs. Now, if that happens to be a 2.5 micron piece of soot or tar, it's actually going to cause inflammation in your lungs. And as we know, inflammation is the root of all evil. And so it's been well known for a long time that the higher the small particles in the environment, the greater the risk and the excess mortality in a population. So back in 2018, this group was getting ready to submit their report to the EPA. And what the report was going to say was that the current levels weren't good enough. The current air quality standards say 12 micrograms of these particles per cubic meter and a 24-hour average of 35 micrograms per cubic meter. The panel was about to recommend a change in that, reducing the permissible level to 10 and the 24-hour level, let's see, I'm not finding it here, but the 24-hour level was reduced substantially as well. And they calculated, by the way, that if they made this change, they could probably reduce deaths attributable to these by 21 to 27%. And the deaths are primarily due to cancer and heart disease, particularly ischemic heart disease. But there has been recent research that we talked about last year that has also linked these small particles and small particle exposure to Alzheimer's and dementia and adverse pregnancy and birth outcomes. Now, of course, this is also a distributive justice issue, because the people who live in the more polluted areas are going to have more diseases and earlier mortality. And in fact, just talking about that, there was a good strong correlation between how sick you got from COVID and whether you were exposed to high levels of these small particles. In other words, your lungs were already kind of pre-inflamed. So this is no bueno. Now, here's cut to the chase. We're back in 2018, right? They're about to publish this report. They all got fired. The panel was disbanded, and a new panel was set up. They basically changed who could be on the panel. Guess what? You don't have just scientists. You now have members who are going to be related to geographic diversity and affiliation with governments. Over 1 year, they replaced the entire membership, banned anyone who gets any non-governmental recipient of EPA scientific research grants from committee membership, which is great because it gets rid of all the scientists, but allowing membership for people affiliated with the regulated industries, which is actually against the law, but hey, a whole lot of things that are against the law happened. They also reduced the number of drafts of a document. They got rid of a lot of things. They instituted a rule called transparency in regulatory science. I love it. You know, whenever something sounds good, check the fine print. This rule excludes from regulatory consideration any scientific study for which data are not publicly available. And that includes things like the Harvard Six Cities and the American Cancer Society studies, which is nuts. So you're basically excluding the best science. And a change in the EPA cost-benefit analysis, this one's subtle, but I really want to read it because it just makes me angry. They're going to exclude co-benefits. So, for example, the mercury and air toxic standard for power plants reduces mercury emission, but also reduces the small particles. And so if you regulate mercury, you're effectively regulating small particles, which amplifies the benefit that you're going to get from regulating the mercury emissions, which they used to think about that. They used to think about aggregate benefit, but oh no, that might put a thumb on the scale against industry. Well, I guess you know whose minions ordered this one, and I just wonder, really, honest to God, folks, how many little Easter eggs are out there sitting, waiting for us to find them, and how long will it take us to find them, and how long will it take us to change things back to, well, from crazy to rational. It's going to be like cleaning out the Aegean stables. That's one of the labors of Hercules, in case you're missing the literary allusion. Our next story, or our next article, presents an interesting walk through, well, let's say, the scientific process and hypothesis testing, and also maybe falls into the silver lining of a cloud, or does it? The article that I'm drawing this from is from the New York Times. It says, did lockdowns lower premature births? A new study adds more evidence to this. And studies in Ireland and Denmark over the summer had shown that preterm births were decreased in the spring during the lockdowns. Doctors around the world also reported similar drops, and people were saying, well, maybe it's reduced stress on the mothers, or maybe it's the cleaner air or better hygiene. A large study just published from the Netherlands, just published in The Lancet Public Health, has yielded even stronger evidence of an association between the lockdowns and a smaller number of early births. Now, you have to understand that just like in the United States, nearly all babies in the Netherlands have a spot of blood collected within a few days after birth and tested for certain diseases, phenylketonuria, etc. Information including the baby's gestational age, is collected at the same time and stored in a database. So the Dutch researchers looked at the screening data from 2010 to 2020. This included more than 1.5 million infants, and over about 56,000 of those babies were born after the Netherlands started locking down in response to the pandemic. So no matter which window, and the researchers looked at, they compared it to previous years, they compared it to earlier trends, seasonal changes in premature birth, which is a known thing. And no matter which window or which way they sliced it or diced it, premature births dropped after March 9th, which was when the government in the Netherlands began warning the public to take more hygiene measures and stay home. The impact was substantial. The reduction in preterm births was from 15 to 23%. So that sounds wonderful. And you begin to wonder, well, could that have something to do with, at least I wondered immediately, and maybe you did if you listened to the previous article, could that have something to do with the reduction in particulates that was also found? On the idea that it's stress, I have lots of friends with kids, and I certainly have worked alongside of doctors with children, and I'll tell you something. Stress levels in women in general did not drop under COVID. If you want to postulate that that 15 to 27% was because the women were more relaxed, having to homeschool their children, having to deal with the fact that they might at any moment get a fatal disease while pregnant, yeah, I don't think we can call it stress reduction because they weren't going to work. And, you know, you've got to be careful what conclusions you draw, because one of the unanswered questions is whether or not there were fewer preemies because instead of being born prematurely, they died. Fetal death was not recorded in the Netherlands in a way that is tracked over time like this, so that the researchers couldn't measure stillbirths in the Dutch data set because only infants who are alive get their heel prick. So what if most of those missing preemies were actually stillborn? There would have been a large increase in stillbirths, like 300%, and no one's reported that, so probably not. There was a hospital in London that showed an increase in stillbirths, but that might have been from undiagnosed coronavirus infections, also because women were just not willing to go out and seek medical care during the pandemic. Mothers, even in Nepal and India, were less likely to give birth in hospitals in the spring, and the stillbirth rates did increase in those countries. And of course, just to make it fun, COVID itself may raise the odds of premature birth. But you've got to look at this and say, at least I'm looking at it and going, I wonder if it's the particulates. I wonder if it's, I don't buy reduced stress. I'll go for cleaner air. I'll even go with better hygiene, because we do know that certain kinds of infections are likely to produce premature birth. But I'll also point out that, speaking as a physician who has been evaluating patients for many years, and I will tell you, under COVID, people's hand washing may have improved, but their body washing didn't. I think the social taboos of not stinking vanish because there's no smell on Zoom. And believe me, I think there was probably plenty of smell in the room on Zoom. Because I have been seeing so many skin infections and rashes and things, other hygiene, skin hygiene related issues in people. In fact, that's probably become one of the more common reasons I see patients in the office, because as I like to say on the radio, you can't diagnose a rash over the radio. I'm kind of thinking of starting a really crazy vaccination meme collection. So if somebody like our previous week's contributor has sent you an email or a crazy assertion about vaccination, why don't you send it along to me? You can send that to Ask Dr. Dawn. You can go to Ask Dr. Dawn and just plonk in the link and or the text. I want to just collect these. I think it's going to be extremely important for us in the healthcare world, and particularly in the public health world, to know what's circulating out there in terms of rumors and toxic memes. So if you've come across a fun toxic meme, feel free to share it. Go to AskDrDawn.com and just plonk it in there, and I'll start my collection. Our next email comes from Jerry. Jerry's in Santa Cruz. Hi, Tylenol is my question. I'm 70. I exercise a lot. My joints get creaky and sore, and Tylenol helps them a lot. Can you say something about how much and how often it's okay to take it, short term or long term? Thanks. Well, Jerry, sorry to hear that you have creaky and sore joints. I have a couple of suggestions for you before we get to the Tylenol. And one of those is high-dose fish oil. How much is high-dose? About 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams a day. So it's easier to take it as a liquid. The cheapest source for that would be cod liver oil. But good luck with that one. I have a little trouble with cod liver oil. Nevertheless, my dog loves it. So to each his own. It's very helpful for the joints. Some people also get a substantial benefit from various herbs like turmeric. And in fact, I have an article that popped up. Let's see if I can find it. Yes, here it is. This was a recent study. It was done in Australia, and it looked at turmeric extract. This is a it was 1,000 milligrams of curcumin, which is an extract of turmeric. And it was a randomized placebo trial, 70 patients, with symptomatic knee arthritis and ultrasound-defined effusion. And what they found was that people who received turmeric for 12 weeks had significantly more improvement than the placebo group. So they had better pain, better function. Didn't really improve their MRI, but I'm not sure I would consider that to be a particular stopper, because I wouldn't expect treatment for 12 weeks to improve an MRI. I would expect it to take more like 6 months. It's kind of like saying, well, the wind stopped, how come the fire isn't out? Yeah, well, because the fire has to burn itself out, and it takes a long time for that to happen. You have to throw a lot of water on an inflammatory fire. And this arthritis, by the way, is osteoarthritis, and that sounds like what you might be getting in your creaky and sore joints. Tylenol is a good painkiller, but it's probably good to be on some anti-inflammatories, hence the curcumin and the fish oil. Also, you might look at glucosamine sulfate. Glucosamine sulfate is a compound that is going to kind of lubricate the cartilage, might make you a little less creaky. Dosing for that is about 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams a day, and that's widely available at health food stores. Even Costco has it. Now, back to your question about Tylenol. The safe dose of Tylenol is 4,000 milligrams a day. That would be 8 extra strength acetaminophen. But that is probably not true for a 70-year-old, and it's especially not true if that 70-year-old ever drinks any alcohol. Alcohol and Tylenol do not mix. And in fact, one of the classic screw-ups is you've got a hangover, you still got some alcohol in your blood, in your bloodstream that's being processed by your liver, and you chow down on some Tylenol to get rid of your hangover headache. Bad idea. The Tylenol and the alcohol compete for breakdown. The problem is that the Tylenol has already been converted by the liver into something really toxic. And so if you then don't immediately use some glutathione to fix that toxin, to get to glucuronidate it and get it out of its highly inflammatory state, you can actually hurt the liver. You can damage the liver cells, and you can, in fact, even kill them with too much of this toxic intermediate. It also depletes your glutathione, which is one of the things you use to get rid of mercury and arsenic and all of the other heavy metals that are part of just walking around in an industrial planet, which we all are, and we're all breathing this stuff. So whether you are very careful or not, you still breathe. So I would say if you're drinking any alcohol within 24 hours, either before or after the Tylenol, very bad idea to take any. And also, you're 70. We're going to assume that you have reasonable liver function. I would say because of your age, you probably want to drop it down to half as much as the allowable dosage. That gets you to 2,000 milligrams, which is probably plenty for you. But if you're going to take that every day, I would ask my doctor to monitor an AST. AST is one of several liver enzymes. You could get a full set of transaminases or liver function tests from your doctor. Sometimes your doctor's doing that annually anyway, but this would be a safety precaution, because if that AST goes up from what it was at your last physical, then you're going to want to not as much Tylenol as you're using. You definitely do not want to see elevated liver enzymes if you're taking regular Tylenol. We're now moving to one of the more interesting articles for today, I think, and this is about bilirubin. Bilirubin. No, it's B-I-L-I-R-U-B-I-N. And bilirubin has always, I was always taught, it's just trash. It's the breakdown product from hemoglobin, which we know carries the oxygen in our blood. It is not a big deal. It's a brownish colored thing. It's what makes poop brown. It's what makes bile, that lovely, interesting kind of ochre shade that is really useful if you're an oil painter, but otherwise you're just not going to use it on your walls. Bilirubin turns out to actually be a megastar, a mega anti-inflammatory product. And in a recent report, this one published in the August 13th New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Lee and others showed that you can use nanoparticles of that are hyaluronic acid on the outside and bilirubin on the inside to treat acute colitis in a mouse model of inflammatory bowel disease. So we're talking about ulcerative colitis here. We're talking about potentially Crohn's disease, very serious, very disabling, and the current drugs we have for them are the monoclonal antibodies, which are too strong, really, and can, in fact, increase cancer risk. It would be lovely to have something that was a little kinder and gentler. They used the hyaluronic as a coating, and it turns out that hyaluronic acid is found in your joints, by the way. It's also used in cosmetics because it improves skin moisture, but it activates innate immunity and it induces type 1 helper T cell responses. So it's a receptor on the surface of the M1 macrophage. Now the M1 macrophage is the one that is present in pathologic inflammatory lesions like rheumatoid arthritis. And when you treat these animal model colitis patients with this combination of hyaluronic and bilirubin, you get amazing improvement. You restore the gut integrity, so you lose the leaky gut. The pro-inflammatory M1 microphages drop, so do the monocytes and the neutrophils. You get increased numbers of anti-inflammatory M2 microphages, also good, and regulatory T cells, also very, very good. So you get, as a result, marked changes in the production of pro-inflammatory and cytokines. And just as a bonus, because there's less inflammation, they saw an increase in the diversity of the gut microbiota, the gut microbiome, in other words, in the direction that was going to maintain that gut barrier integrity, and an increase in anti-inflammatory bacteria species like Akkermansia muciniphilia, which we've talked about many times on this program, because it's an anti-inflammatory bacteria. You don't want too much of it. This is the thing about biology. You don't want too much, because too much is going to have unintended consequences. It's going to bite you on the behind. So don't go chowing down on loads of Akkermansia, because if you eat it, it's called mucinophilia for a reason. It likes to eat mucin. So if you've got a lot of it, it'll actually eat your gut mucus and give you leaky gut. So it's a Goldilocks phenomenon, right? Not too much, not too little, get it just right. Another researcher is actually treating pancreatitis in rats using silk, nanoparticles of silk with bilirubin inside, and putting these into the bloodstream. It turns out that the silk homes in on inflammatory lesions in the pancreas. It's dissolved by trypsin, which is an enzyme that the pancreas is leaking in the areas that are damaged. And so when it gets there, as it circulates through, the silk is actually melted by the spilled enzyme from the disease, and the bilirubin is just released like flame retardant out of a helicopter exactly where it needs to go in the inflamed area.
They've been able to show that they get a suppression of NF-kappa-B, which is like the major signaling in the genome, basically in the DNA that turns on the COX-2 and the enzyme that makes the prostaglandins, which are pro-inflammatory, and the LOX-1, which makes the leukotrienes, which are pro-inflammatory. So you see how it all fits together? It's this enormous web of interaction and signaling. This pathway also prevents oxidative stress, so that helps prevent cancer. Bilirubin is turning out to be I would almost say it's a hormone. It's cytoprotective. It's anti-apoptotic, so it protects cells. It's anti-cancer, and it has hormone-like activities. It affects the immune system in many positive ways, and it's really astonishing because there is, in the medical literature already, reports of a negative association between serum bilirubin concentrations and Crohn's disease. In other words, if your serum bilirubin is high, then you're not putting it into your gut. It's backing up. So your Crohn's disease is going to get worse. They are basically reciprocal, like a teeter-totter. Really amazing. The nanoparticles are interesting, and we've talked last week about using this concept of nanoencapsulation. And by the way, this is different than gold nanoparticles. This is different than like the evil nano that everyone is so worried about. This is just a liposome. It's a very, very, very small liposome, but it's just a fat bubble. Or in this case of the second one, a silk bubble. That's so poetic, isn't it? A bubble of silk cures your disease, cures your inflammation. Wow, I like that. Our last email, we'll wrap up this week's show, comes from Amber in Kettle Falls, Washington. Supplement recommendations. Dear Dr. Don, I may be remembering wrong, but I feel like in the past there was a link on the website to recommendations for supplements that everyone should take, like calcium, magnesium, but it was a specific kind or a specific ratio, fish oil with how many omegas, D3 with how much to take. I couldn't find it when I was looking through the website. Could you either send me a link or let me know what those recommendations were? After having kids, I stopped taking supplements because life was just crazy, but my twins are now 5. Twins, yes. And I'm ready to make my health a priority again. Thanks. I love the how and the show and have been listening since the early 2000s. Amber. Thank you, Amber. Really appreciate the email. So we've just got a few minutes, but that's all right because it's going to be just enough time. Let's start with the calcium and magnesium. In functional medicine, we feel like it's important that the calcium and the magnesium be balanced. And so it's good to take a 50-50 ratio. And there's a lot of argument right now about how much, but if you're taking calcium supplements, you probably want to also be taking vitamin K2 to be sure that you direct that calcium. It's like a railroad switch, and the K2 sends the calcium to the bones
and keeps it out of the arteries.
This is very good. You also don't want to take large quantities of calcium because after you get above 500, you do start to see an increase in kidney stones. And definitely after you get over 1,000, there's a problem there. Statistically, not everybody's going to have it. The fish oil is omega-3s. You want DHA and EPA. Those are the two really actionable ones. And for general health, I recommend people take an EPA-DHA supplement between 500 and 1,000. If you never eat fish, 1,000. If you eat fish 2 or 3 times a week, I hope it's not tuna fish because of the mercury, but then you probably can get by with 500 daily, unless we're using it to weaponize to bring down cholesterol or something like that. The last question you had was about vitamin D. How much to take on vitamin D depends on where you start. So you should get a vitamin D level. And then you should shoot for, right now in the time of COVID, between 40 and 50 as your goal. So if you start out at 30, you're technically okay, but I still think you can be better by getting it up to 40. So you can take 5,000 a day and take that for 3 months and then repeat the vitamin D level. It comes up slowly, people vary quite a bit in their absorption, but I've never had anybody get toxic on 5,000 a day for 3 months. And there is published in the literature that when you start taking more than 10,000, you can get those levels above 100, which may start to be bad for you. So I hope that I've been good for you, and I hope that the next week will be good for you. We've come to the end of the hour. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.